listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Hello and welcome to The Lyric Feature. This week we return to our series Feather and Flock, in which the ecologist Anya Murray and the folk musician Brian McLean turn their gaze skyward and fix their attention on our wild birds. This week they're craning their necks even further than usual, all the better to make out that distant speck, the skylark.
Welcome to Feather and Flock, a series about some of Ireland's most iconic birds. Each episode explores the unique life strategy of a selected species, the habitats where they have evolved to thrive, and the folklore, poetry, and songs that surround them. But first, let's introduce ourselves. My name is Anya Murray. I'm an ecologist and a writer. I love being out in nature, observing the ways of wild creatures. I'm always curious to discover what's behind their behaviour, and that's the kind of thing we love delving into here on Feather and Flock.
And I'm Brian McLean. I'm a musician and a songwriter, mostly with my band Ye Vagabonds. I've also always been obsessed with the natural world, and I'm particularly fond of birds. For this series, I've been uncovering some of the stories, songs and folk associations that place certain birds so firmly in our culture. And for each episode, I've curated and written both new and old music with a host of collaborators to illustrate the lives of these little beings. Anya and I are delighted to present this fourth episode, which is all about the most accomplished of songbirds, the skylark. Because skylarks have had a huge influence on Irish music and on Uilleann piping in particular, master piper Emmett Gill will be playing some lark-inspired tunes for this episode.
Skylarks are unassuming in their appearance, but from February right through spring and summer, they can be heard belting out their songs, loud and clear, from way above. This draws our attention up, up and up, till we can just about spot a tiny speck in the open sky. It's hard to believe that the song that pours down is coming from such a delicate little creature, hovering in midair, so high above us, all the while singing so impressively. This behaviour is so celebrated that in medieval times it was considered symbolic of the joyous spirit of the divine. And over the centuries, skylark and their songs have made frequent appearances in literature and poetry. To get a poet's perspective on skylark, Brian and I met with poet Martin Dyer.
About the times when I have encountered skylarks, and it seems to me that they have a way of insinuating themselves into your consciousness, that you might have been filtering them out. It might have been mere birdsong and you might have been going about your business or there with your thoughts, and then suddenly you're aware that there's persistent music somewhere. The melodiousness and the trilling and all of that takes you somewhere, but uninterrupted sound. And that's key to the skylark. Suddenly you notice that it's there. You become aware that for many minutes they've been labouring away exquisitely in their song flight. in his poem The Tollan Man in Springtime, which is a relatively late poem from Seamus Heaney, when he returns to an early subject, he imagines his main character, a man who was murdered ritualistically many centuries ago, returning or finding a way to get into the contemporary world. The larks appear suddenly. It's in its way very passionate, but kind of a cryptic poem. The Tollan Man tells the reader that he was driven by a sixth sense, which had a kind of an underlining threat about it. There were snipe that were panicking, and as Heaney says, off-shooting into twilight. And I've been struck by the fact that when Seamus Heaney mentions the lark, the snipe is not far behind. There are several moments where he invokes the lark, and then he thinks of the snipe. And there are probably good reasons for that in terms of the way that the lark sends Seamus Heaney into his own boyhood, sends him back to his native experience of being from a farming family in Derry. But then the next image is larks quietened in the sun. And the next image is clear alteration in the bog pooled rain. And this kind of cryptical and it's fair to say kind of mystical language is setting up a threshold for the Tollan Man to cross. Snipe panicking, larks quietened in the sun, and then some sort of stilling in bog water that facilitates the emergence of this character into the contemporary world. I reawoke to revel in the spirit they strengthened when they chose to put me down for their own good. And to a sixth sensed threat, panicked snipe off shooting into twilight, then going awry, larks quietened in the sun, clear alteration in the bog pooled rain. Now, there's a lovely short poem by Michael Longley called Horseshoe, and which again is larks plural. And you could question this. Why spontaneously would an older poet incorporating the lark into the poem perhaps more naturally say plural? And the answer is probably because the spectacle of larks flocking together in some way is more realistic, more palpable, more plausible, as it inevitably is less so for a writer from a younger generation. Horseshoe has a lovely narrative. He sees a flock of larks rising up on the boreen ahead of him. And when he comes to the point where the skylarks had been on the ground, he finds an old horseshoe. So it's an impressionistic piece, but there's a very confident sense from the poet that they're offering the reader something beautiful. What do the skylarks know? What sort of integratedness is there between the life of the horse and the life of the birds in this pastoral setting? I find a rusty horseshoe where skylarks rise from the sheep shitty path. God sparks, sound glints for bridle and bridle hand. I am the farrier in this townland.
Skylarks are synonymous with their song. Their constant twittering solos, lasting up to 20 minutes at a time, have inspired songs, tunes, and all kinds of art for centuries. But our ears can't even hear half of what they're actually singing. Have a listen to this skylark singing. And then the same clip, slowed down to a seventh of its normal speed, so that our human ears are able to actually hear the complexity of the tune. Even when we listen quickly like this, we can hear repeated phrases, ornaments, and notes that would be lost on us otherwise. It's no wonder that the skylark has inspired a lot of innpiping tunes in Ireland. These ornaments and phrases are a little bit similar to the crans and rolls of the pipes. A famous old tune called the Lark's March is said to have been directly inspired by a skylark singing. The story goes that two pipers were in a competition, each one playing tune for tune, one as good as the other, all night long. As dawn broke, they took a break from playing, and one piper stepped outside to smoke his pipe and watch the sunrise. A skylark rose from the hills outside the house, and the piper listened in awe for a while, before returning inside. Inspired by the lark and the tune he had just heard, he improvised the tune, The Lark's March, and the other piper couldn't repeat it back to him, and so he was declared the master piper.
When they're hovering in the air, skylarks have to beat their wings rapidly to remain in place at a rate of 10 to 12 beats per second. This is how they take their stage, between 30 and 100 metres up in the sky, allowing their song to ring out far and wide. While performing this already impressive feat, they also roll out songs containing complex combinations of sound, barely repeating a phrase throughout. To find out more about skylarks' unique approach to song and how evolution has equipped them to manage such impressive melodious feats, Brian and I went one late summer day to meet with Professor John Quinn in North County Cork. John teaches in the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences in University College Cork, and he's an expert in the behaviour, ecology and evolution of birds.
You know, most birds, when they're singing, they do it from a perch, whereas skylarks like to fly up as high as they can go and sing. And they can sing sometimes up to 15, 20 minutes at a time. You know, they have this constant, very melodious, complex song. And, you know, if you're out walking the countryside, you come across this amazing song. You don't know where it's coming from because the bird is so high you can't see it. So they have this sort of mystical feel about them because it is so difficult to spot them when they're actually singing.
Because I've seen them in upland bogs, I've seen them in lowland grassland as well, even in Phoenix Park, and they just hover. It's like a constant chorus of song. It's really beautiful.
Well, and that is actually pretty unique, because most birds, when they sing, they do it in bursts. You know, they'll sing for a while, they'll take a break and they'll sing again. But this is just the thing that makes male skylarks really stand out to the females. They can say, look, I'm so fit, I can stay up here in the air for, you know, 10, 15 minutes singing continuously, and that makes me very attractive. And when you think about how they actually manage to do that, it's pretty remarkable. Because when we're talking as humans, you have to take a breath to be able to, you know, say your next word or whatever. Skylarks don't need to do that. They have a very complex system of not just lungs, but also these air sacs. They're able to breathe continuously without pausing to take breath. So when they take their first breath in, that air goes to the back of the air sacs. Okay, and then they take their next breath out. Well, that goes into the lungs when the previous breath comes out of the mouth. I do speak to students about this in one of my lectures, and one of the analogies that springs to mind when you talk about this constant movement of air with the inland pipes, you know. There are parallels there.
Skylarks are such accomplished singers that they can even produce two notes at the same time, which means that a lot of their syllables are effectively harmonizing with themselves. I can only wonder what it must be like to be able to sing like they do.
And all birds vocalize, for sure. They produce sounds, but not all birds produce song. So probably about two-thirds to three-quarters of birds do produce song, and song can be kind of defined by its complexity, really. You know, call is just a simple syllable, maybe, but songs are made up of lots of notes, and notes make syllables, syllables make phrases, and different groups of phrases make song. So that points to quite a bit of complexity that is only in a certain proportion of species.
Okay, so the quacking of a duck, then, yeah, we wouldn't classify as singing as such, or even the squeak of a hawk or something isn't really singing.
No, it's not. Those are just contact calls or alarm calls, or there's a variety of different kinds of calls that most birds use, and they're to do with simple things, keeping in touch with each other, letting each other know that they've seen the predator, be it a hawk or something on the ground. But song takes those vocalizations to a greater degree of complexity. You know, there are multiple reasons, okay? One of them, probably the best known reason, is that it's thought to attract females. Females are known in quite a few species to prefer males who produce more complex songs. And the reason for that is it's meant to indicate their quality. Our males who produce complex songs often are more successful at producing young, and they've measured that in a couple of ways. One is in, you know, the number of young they produce at their own nests, but also the number of young that they sire at other nests which are not their own. And that's what we refer to as extra pair paternity. So in other words, the neighboring females are eavesdropping on the neighboring males and think, ooh, I like the sound of that bird's song. Maybe I'll go and have a talk with him. So, and that's one of the reasons they have these really complex songs.
Amazing. So that's evolution at work. The more complex the song, the more offspring these particular males are having, and that's evolution, right?
Yeah, it's sexual selection specifically. Okay. That's what we refer to as a sort of a sexually selected trait, song. What is amazing about song is that it is actually quite complicated, and the skylark is a good example of this. You know, we often talk about song complexity or song repertoire size. An individual might have up to 60, 70 song types.
A repertoire of 70 different songs.
That's right. Now, a lot of them might sound quite similar, but they're distinct enough to be able to call them different types of songs.
Wow.
Now,
Brian, would you know 60 or 70 different songs?
Yeah.
You would?
Yeah. Well, that's because I have to try and make myself very attractive to females, obviously.
That's obvious. Obviously.
But there's a thing, there's a concept, you know, there's a ballad singing tradition, say, in the Balkans, where people would sing songs that could last 3 hours. One song could last 3 hours, following certain patterns of, you know, rhyme, rhythm, meter, melodic structure. But the whole thing is kind of improvised, actually. it was studied because a lot of these singers would also be illiterate. So they couldn't possibly have memorized all those words. So I do wonder about birdsong when it comes to, you know, a bird like the skylark or the song thrush or, you know, birds that mimic each other and stuff. How much of that is genetic code and how much of it is just kind of riffing around? Do people know that?
Well, the song, it has genetic components for sure, but most song is actually learned. And it's actually learned, they begin to learn when the birds are, when the chicks are still in the nest. They're listening to their parents and to their neighbours, and that's where they're getting their first sort of exposure to song. And, you know, we actually know how they do this. So the process involves them, first of all, listening to that song, forming a template of it in one particular part of the brain. And then later, when they begin to practice that song, they produce it with a different or different parts of the brain. They compare it to the template and they keep on modifying it until it matches that template as well as they can. And what's remarkable about birdsong is that it develops in a very similar way to the way speech develops in infants. So we talk about children having a sort of a babbling talk when they're very young. Well, birds also have a babbling song. It's basically random sounds. And that eventually crystallizes, is the official term that they use in the birdsong one, as they match what they're producing to what they have in the template in their brain.
Hearing John talk about all the ways that skylarks can use their voices, with multiple notes at once, singing without taking a breath, and the incredible diversity of their repertoires and styles, it's no wonder to me that larks and their singing come up so often in our folk songs. My brother Germans and I have been singing together since we were barely hatched ourselves, and like a lot of people in Ireland, it can be hard to remember when or how we learned our first songs. One of these is a song that evokes the lark's rising song and flight so well that even if you've never seen a lark, you'll probably recognize one after hearing this song. It's a traditional song. It's called The Lark in the Morning.
She rises off her nest and she goes up in the air with the dew all on her breast. And like the jolly ploughboy, she whistles and she sings and she goes home in the evening with the dew all on her wings. Roger the ploughboy, he is a dashing blade, and he goes whistling and singing in yonder leafy shade. He met with dark-eyed Susan, as handsome I declare, and she's far more enchanting than the birds all in the air. He met with dark-eyed Susan, as handsome I declare, and he brought a roll of ribbon for to reel around her hair. The lark in the morning, she rises off her nest, and she goes up in the air with the dew all on her breast. And like the jolly ploughboy, she whistles and she sings, and she goes home in the evening with the dew all on her wings. As they were coming home from the wakes of the town, the meadow being mown and the grass was all cut down. If we should chance to tumble all in the new mown hay, well, and it's kiss me now or never, this pretty girl would say. The lark in the morning, she rises off her nest, and she goes up in the air with the dew all on her breast. And like the jolly ploughboy, she whistles and she sings, and she goes home in the evening with the dew all on her wings. 20 long weeks were over and past. Her mammy chanced to notice how she thickened round her waist. It was the pretty ploughboy, this young girl, she did say, for he caused me to tumble all in the new mown hay. The lark in the morning, she rises off her nest, and she goes up in the air with the dew all on her breast. And like the jolly ploughboy, she whistles and she sings, and she goes low in the evening with the dew all on her wings.
After hearing about the ways that skylarks learn their songs, why they sing, and the complexity and mastery of their repertoires, I couldn't help but notice that the process is remarkably similar to how humans learn to sing in oral traditions like the Irish singing tradition. Just like the skylark, we learn by immersion, listening, imagining, and recreating the sounds of our environment using tunes, phrases, and motifs we've heard. In order to shine a light on the complexities of what we have in common with our feathered friends, I spoke to Triana Nichiachon, established professor of music and performing arts and head of the School of English Media and Creative Arts at University of Galway. In her work, Triana has described the way we learn and share songs in Ireland as a process of creatively reimagining songs. We began by talking about the skylark and what their approach to singing might have in common with ours. During this conversation, we'll also hear a couple of songs from the legendary and beautiful Moosecree singer, Bess Cronin.
It's lovely hearing you talk about, you know, the birds constantly singing and we're listening to them there, and it's just so beautiful. The humans aren't that dissimilar, actually, particularly traditionally. Modernity has become very quiet comparatively to, say, maybe how things might have been in Ireland 100 years ago even, or even 50 years ago. The accounts that we have of singing in Ireland from the 19th century and the early 20th century would be that it was this constant sound world. Like, people were practically constantly singing. Brown Donald Madogáin himself used to talk about how Irish people used to be singing literally from the cradle to the grave. The place was awash with song. I remember somebody told me years ago that, say, in North Cork now, in the first half of the 20th century, you know, there were no doorbells, of course. So the custom was that if you're going up to somebody else's house, you'd be either singing to yourself, or you might be lilting or whistling to yourself, or if that failed you, you'd be talking to yourself, just so the people would hear you coming. But it's very different, I suppose, to a lot of people's experience of singing in modern life, because typically now people might buy a ticket to go to a gig, or they turn on the radio, of course, or they might buy a CD. But traditionally, it was a really, really widespread practice. Everybody was at it. Like, nowadays, we think of, you know, going to a class, and a lot of people go to singing teachers now, whereas traditionally, that's not how it happened at all. It would have happened completely through immersion. And it's interesting to think of lilting or didling or what is called puss music. Nobody's ever taught how to lilt. You just, you know, you open your mouth one day and you're able to do it.
What would you do if you married a soldier? What would they do but your fellow is gone? And what would you do if you date in the ocean? What would they do but you marry again?
It's an interesting phenomenon. You know, it's a beautiful creative practice. And singing would be similar. A lot of people wouldn't have been formally taught. I'll never forget hearing Paddy Vorhin MacGarrett, the great singer from West Kerry, saying, for example, "Near Aulamis, Riav, Auron, I never learnt a song." Now, of course, he's hundreds of songs. So what does he mean by that? That he never actually went and learnt it off by heart. I think that he learnt them by osmosis. And that's traditionally how it was done. So I often compare it to like how we learn a language. Our mammies and daddies didn't have to be beside our cot, you know, reading out, you know, a grammar book to us for us to learn the incredible sophisticated complexities of our mother tongue. And so in a way, singing is sort of like mother music, you know, as in it's the way that we have a mother tongue. It's something traditionally that was acquired in Irish, you know, you'd say, you know, shalavitr na hauroin, you know, that they're sort of, you bring them into you. And so it's interesting, but also just the constant nature of it. And you'd hear that with a lot of great singers, just the constant nature of their singing, be that out in the fields. We've lovely accounts of that, men singing out in the fields, women in the farmyard, in the house, you know, and any sort of domestic labour was accompanied by singing. And then children were just exposed to constant song, really.
So it's kind of, I suppose, they'd be absorbing all of that sound around them, and they'd be absorbing maybe the styles and the tunes and the even just the ornaments of people's language. Yeah. What would be the next step then in that process if you were learning?
Oral traditional learning is, in many, many cultures, the act of learning is an act of recomposition, which is just an interesting thing. And so to transmit a song is to sort of to recreate it as your own. Singers used to actually never sing a song the same way twice. Even on the level of the words, there'd be an element of recomposition happening. But on the level of the music, nowadays is where you hear it most pronounced, maybe, because the melody of songs, even though you can recognise, oh yeah, that's Caithé Mania, or that's Madanol in Gréine, or that's Yomari Shukrushkin, or whatever you'd be listening to, you know it's the song, but actually the melody doesn't stay the same. And that sort of complex system where you have learning, transmission and composition all seem to overlap as if they're the same process. You have these incredible series of motifs that, you know, combine and recombine in different ways. So it's incredible thinking of people being immersed in this sound world of musical ideas like these motifs. And how then that informs how they sing themselves and how they compose, if they're composing a new tune or song. But essentially, you can't really fully distinguish the singer from the composer in the Irish tradition. And it is a brilliant example. Like, if you were to pick a tradition to compare to the birds singing in the trees, it would be the Irish tradition, because it is expansive and extensive and old. And my God, is there mastery there, you know?
Yeah. It's, well, a fascinating thing that I just discovered. Apparently birds, like the skylark, they know now that they actually have a repertoire of about 70 songs. A lot of these birds have a repertoire of distinct songs that they can actually recognise. And I suppose one of the things that I find fascinating about it is that it seems like they learn in exactly the same way as you're describing.
Yeah.
Just like you're saying that they pick up a song from other birds who might be from a different region. I suppose that is kind of similar to the Irish tradition, maybe, in that sometimes I'd be out at a session in Dublin and I might hear a singer, I'd say, they must have learned from Cormac McRae or whoever, that they have such a distinctive style. That is that the case, that they're, it's that recognisable, but there's, it's not imitation exactly then, is it?
No, it's not. It's not imitation. It's sort of, again, a moment of recreation, but you still hear the beautiful sort of, how do you say, like the encounter, whatever encounter happened, you know, was it that they were inspired by Cormac McRae's beautiful singing, or what, it might have been their grandmother. And often it's people you've never met. And so, like, traditional singing tends to have this really multi-vocal quality in that sense. You know, there's lots of people's voices in any one song, because that's the nature of the sort of the transmission process. And it's interesting drawing comparisons between, like, it's amazing listening to you talking about the style of bird song or the different song types. And even when you mention 70 songs, like, you know, great singers would have had at least 100 songs. You know, so you're sort of talking about the same region. It's amazing, like, and indeed some of them, like Nóra Ní Chonaill from Ballyvourna, had 200 songs easily, you know, you'd have even more than that. The oral tradition in Ireland, even though we associate it strongly with Irishness, and we're right to do so because it's very distinctive to what is happening on this island, at the same time, it's actually a global tradition and always was, because we find this incredible constellation of both literary and musical motifs stretching all around the world. Like you'd have motifs in common between Persia and Muscovy, for example. Song is a human and sophisticated way of playing with time. When somebody sings, ordinary time actually stops. We've heard a lot so far about skylarks and their singing, as we tend to hear them a lot more than see them. In terms of how they look, they're small and inconspicuous, with speckledy brown feathers. Speckledy brown is a good colour if you're a bird that feeds by plucking found things off the ground. They eat a lot of plant seeds and grain. In spring and summer, they pluck grubs, beetles, grasshoppers and spiders from the ground. The kind of things found in healthy habitats, rich in invertebrate life. And because skylarks also nest on the ground, their cryptic coloration helps them avoid being eaten by predators. Their adaptability means that skylarks have always been fairly widespread across Ireland. In England and across Europe, they're associated with cereal crops. But here in Ireland, skylarks prefer to breed in open, grassy habitats, such as tussocky farmland pasture, lightly grazed open heathland and low-growing coastal grasslands. Wherever there are plenty of little herbs and wildflowers in among the grassy sward and a light grazing regime, skylarks are assured a plentiful food supply and optimal breeding conditions. But over the past 40 years or so, these species-rich grassland habitats have succumbed to changing land use. Vast swathes of once nature-friendly farmland have been converted into monocultures of ryegrass for intensive dairy. With fewer invertebrates to eat and more cows to trample nests, skylarks don't do well. Silage doesn't suit them much either. Herbicides and pesticides further diminish the diversity that sustains skylarks and their wild peers. All this amounts to bad news for skylarks. There are now 30% less skylarks in Ireland than there were in the 1970s. The song of the skylark, once a staple sound of Irish farmland, is now restricted to farmland refugia in the northwest and west of Ireland only, where farming hasn't changed so dramatically. At least we know what's causing the decline, and we have the choice to prevent it going any further. Equipped with this knowledge, there's even a possibility that skylark populations could bounce back. It's simply a matter of our choosing whether or not to offer better support for nature-friendly farming.
Skylarks have always been celebrated for their singing, even if it is only in recent times that we can fully understand and hear the complexities of their tunes. I've been struck by their song on the Connemara coast in February, on Ironmore Island in April and May, and in the Phoenix Park in Dublin through the height of summer. And always, I'm bowled over by just what an incredible thing it is to have going on, right up above our heads. I can't imagine not having skylarks singing out through the spring and summer months. Because they're also so eager to perform, it's hardly any wonder that they've had such a strong presence in Irish folklore and song. I met with Rianach Iogain, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and former Director of the National Folklore Collection in UCD, who shared some of what she knows about skylarks in Irish folklore.
Songs find their own home and they're constantly on the move. They adapt themselves and singers adapt to suit language, area, psyche. And a very common motif in the lyrical love songs in Irish in particular, and in English, in the songs in English, where lovers are together until the break of day, until the cock crow. And in a version of An Chulainn, we have An Cuimhne Chleatsán Iahu d'Iabhí Mise Go Inniog, Rug Tú Trí Mo Lár Orm Agus Dáis Tú Orm Barog, Hín Mise Síslat, Mar Bhí Mé Gan Orachod, Is Bhí Mé Do Chóludar, Go Chúise An Isiog. So do you remember that night when I was at the window? You embraced me and you gave me a hug. I lay down beside you. I was innocent and I was with you until the lark woke us. A lively song from Mayo, from the Gaeltacht in County Mayo, called An Siúsóg, which refers to the half of a blanket. It's a laflid, I suppose, is what you call it in Irish. And we see here that the lark, the arrival of the lark, is seen as a point in time. Acha diga an tarach is acha scala an morta, acha graha an ishogi hainer a grieve. Baram na quira, tiach na fail porik, be plizela in ori ag banan veri. So when spring comes and the sunshine comes in March, when the skylark shakes herself into action and I'll be shearing the sheep when St. Patrick's Day comes, and Ban and Vary, the Mrs. Berry, will be making another blanket. And there are sayings in Irish and in English about the lark, and always as cheery and bright as the lark, for example. Aire leis a bhuiseog le fáin in a fuiseoga, to rise with the lark. Chobín leis a bhuiseog, as sweet sounding, as melodious as the lark, as bright as a lark. And a phrase that I came across in one of the folklore collections in a story. The man listened to him with attention like the lark in the field of corn. And we have some weather omens as well about the lark. If a lark builds the nest in hollows left by cattle on the mountain, it's a sign of dry weather. But if the lark builds the nest on the sheltered side of the hill or in a hole in a ditch, it's a sign of wet weather. And it's not a good omen, however, to hear the lark after sunset. In the school's manuscript collection that was undertaken between 1937 and 1938, we get accounts of the lark. It's music, but more so a description, physical description of the bird. We're told in one account that the cuckoo builds no nest of his own at all, but he lays his egg in a lark's nest, and this is the reason why the cuckoo is usually followed by the lark. And we're told that the lark builds her nest on the ground, generally in cow's tracks. It's made of very fine hay. She lays blackish eggs. And when the young larks are hatched, they're very healthy. They grow feathers very quickly. And after about 3 days, they leave the nest and creep among the grass. They do this because if they stopped in the nest too long, they might get trampled on by some animal, or a hawk might pounce on them and kill them. And a story is told, not in song form, not the Song of Lies, but a story is told of a prisoner who escaped and came to a particular district, and he was put in prison. But he was told then that he would be set free if he could tell queer lies. So the man started straight away and said, I saw a buck flee saving hay for the Lord of Tyrone, and Kilkenny town going down to visit Athlone, and Carrickfergus drawing salt to Carrickmacross. I have seen the new custom house thrown down by the wind of a bat. I saw a sparrowhawk in Dundalk mending shoes, and a lark with spectacles reading the news, And there it is all for you without a word of a lie. And so he was let free.
Little ones have fledged. Skylarks move away from open breeding habitats. They take leave of the uplands and the west coast where they have been all spring and summer and move eastward for the winter months. By February, they'll be out singing again, finding their way among the heathers of upland areas, hovering high over Connemara grasslands and celebrating their return to the grassy pastures that skylarks have always called home. In the words of poet John Clare, skylarks make the land itself more vivid.
People have always been quick to place a higher value on literature and formally taught classical art forms. But oral traditions involve at least as much complexity and mastery as other art forms. In the same way, maybe we could recognize that we have a lot more in common with other animals than we think. Skylarks, too, have a continuous singing tradition that spans generations, a complex culture that we're only beginning to recognise. With all the optimism that they have been allocated on our behalf, we might look to the song of the skylark to help guide us as we restore our broken relationship with nature.
Feather and Flock, Skylark, was presented by the ecologist Anya Murray and the folk musician Brian McGlynn. The programme was produced by Anya Murray and the sound supervision was by Brian McGlynn. Piper Emmett Gill played a selection of lark-related traditional tunes on the Illan Pipes for this episode. The Lark's March, The Lark in the Morning, The Skylark, The Lark on the Strand and The Mountain Lark, as well as The Slow Air on Cossadhoc Bawn, which were recorded by Brian McGlynn at Napeabury Illan on Henrietta Street in Dublin. The traditional song The Lark in the Morning was arranged, performed and recorded especially for this programme by Brian McGlynn and Dermot McGlynn of Ye Vagabonds. We also heard Elizabeth Bess Cronin sing two short songs, Girline, Don't Be Idle, and What Would You Do If You Married a Soldier? And a special thank you to Dáilvigh Ócronan for the permission to use these recordings of his grandmother, whose songs can all be found in his brilliant book with accompanying CDs, The Songs of Elizabeth Cronin. All other music and score was written, arranged and produced by Brian McGlynn. The soundscapes and wild birds were recorded in the field by Brian and Sean Ronayne of Irish Wildlife Sounds.